Holland, which was the best men's store in Dayton. So I interviewed him a couple of times in Dayton. I also interviewed him in Columbus when I was with the Columbus Dispatch. While I was at Ohio State, I interviewed some famous football coaches of the time. I remember the day that Newt Rockne was killed in a plane crash in Kansas. Don Miller, one of the Four Horsemen, was an assistant coach at Ohio State, and I spent that evening in Don Miller's hotel room interviewing him about Rockne. Miller later became a federal judge in Cleveland. Anyhow, I'm back to Dayton, Ohio, where I covered sports, and in 1940, the editor of the Dayton Journal-Herald called me into his office. His name was Dwight, but everybody knew him as Deke, capital Deke Young. He was a crusty conservative Republican, and he said he wanted me to leave the sports department and write news. He had an idea that he wanted to develop somebody into what he called a star reporter. Well, I had covered some news at the Columbus Dispatch, but not much, and I really had no interest in covering news, but he wanted me to be a news writer, and I became a news writer. So I covered general news then for the Dayton Journal-Herald. I covered City Hall. I covered some politics. And in about 1941, I was appointed Sunday editor of the Dayton Journal-Herald.
Is that quite a post?
That was a big job. I think it paid $47.50 a week.
That's big money
That was in
for those
19
days.
about 1940, and at the time, I was courting the girl whom I later married, Beatrice Perlman, Perlman, of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Her mother and my parents had known each other in Berdichev and were friends. So I used to drive up to Fort Wayne, about 125 miles from Dayton, on weekends, well, we married
Yes, you did.
in 19 November 2nd, 1941.
And you owned your own car then?
The time when I was writing sports in Dayton, I had to have a car to get out to golf courses and to the University of Dayton, and I bought a used Chevrolet, and when I married Bea, her folks gave us a car, and we had a very inexpensive honeymoon in Gatlinburg in Tennessee in the Smoky Mountains. Who went to Europe on honeymoons?
Yeah, these were different times.
They sure were. Anyhow, I wrote news, and then it was Sunday editor in 1940, 41. That job consisted largely of editing. I did almost no writing in that job, but supervised the stories that were used in the Sunday magazine section.
And you selected them.
And I selected
Made
them
this
and assigned
decision.
them, made assignments to
Right.
reporters.
Tell us, for the historians, since this was before wage and hours and unions and all that stuff, how long a week did you work? How long was a day
I
for
want to
you?
say, if I can go back to the when I worked at Adler and Childs in the department store advertising, is it possible? I worked 8 days a week because we worked 6 days, and if they wanted me to come in on Sunday, I worked on Sunday. And from Thanksgiving to Christmas, it was monstrous. We worked every night, so literally, we were working 7 or 8 days a week.
And
And but
12 hours a day.
I was already making $25 a week, though. So,
which was
but,
big money.
But there was of course no unions or anything.
No.
Now, when I got into the newspaper business, we had no union. We worked a 6-day week. And
of how many hours a day?
Well, like? In sports, it was. I came in addition to working Monday through Friday, about 8 hours a day. We had a Sunday paper, and we also had a Saturday afternoon paper, so we had to come in at Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, get out the Sunday paper, and it was the off-season. We stayed till 12 or 1 o'clock and came back about 6 Saturday night and worked till 2 o'clock Sunday morning to get out the Sunday paper. But if I came in on Saturday at 7 o'clock to help get out the Saturday sport pages, and I left at 1 o'clock to go cover a baseball game or a football game, I worked straight through till 2 o'clock Sunday morning. So during the football and basketball seasons, it was nothing to work from 7 in the morning, Saturday morning, till 2 o'clock Sunday morning.
19 or 20 hours.
Of course. You know, you could get an hour off for dinner.
Like how did you, when did you eat or sleep?
Well, you would. You got out the Saturday paper.
Right.
And then you had lunch or something, and then you went to a football game and came back and wrote the story. But
right.
Then you had to start reading copy on stories that were in the mm-hmm. Sunday paper, and you just stayed.
I think the point you're making historically is that in the newspaper business, you worked long, hard hours, but wasn't it true in other fields, too?
It was.
For example, in the retail business, people would work 6 days a week,
nine to nine. I was in the retail advertising business, and that's
and
how we worked.
Long hours.
And
12 hours a day.
And no overtime. Now, when I was at the Dayton Journal-Herald, Haywood Bruin had founded the American Newspaper Guild, which is now the newspaper guild. And we tried to form a guild. We finally did. And we had a newspaper guild. And we got some improved conditions, a 5-day week, and better salaries. They weren't great. But
well, what year was
improved.
That, if you can
well,
remember?
Well, I remember literally courting my wife to be in Fort Wayne over a weekend. And driving back, I was off on Mondays because I had to work Saturdays. And I would leave Fort Wayne on Monday morning to drive back to Dayton to go to a negotiating meeting. We were trying to
1941.
We were trying to get our first contract.
The first union contract.
That was
Is that what you
that
call
was
it?
The first new, that was a union, yes.
Yeah.
It was a labor union. It later became affiliated with the AFL-CIO, and I'm still a member.
Well, what about the... I know something about newspapers. What about the newspaper printers union, typographical
The
unions?
Printers were organized.
Were they organized?
The printers, the stereotypers, the mailers...
The Teamsters? Was there a Teamsters
the
union?
The Teamsters, I don't think, were organized when I was in Dayton. They are now. But the mechanical employees had
unions.
But people in the editorial department, you would ask somebody to join or try to get somebody to join the union, and they'd say, I'm not a working man or woman, I'm a professional.
Right.
And they abhorred the idea of joining a union until they found out that a union might improve their lot in life.
Yes. So would you say that's why Hearst and all those multimillionaire newspaper owners were wealthy because they underpaid.
Of course. Oh, I've got to go back if you're on this subject.
Yeah.
When I started as a kid in high school writing high school sports, even though I wrote a story for a major daily newspaper every day, they paid us high school kids $2 a week. So I got $2 really on my first job.
Yeah.
And then I also wrote high school news in addition to sports, and they paid me another $2 for that. Nobody will believe that. I know it's true, but nobody else will believe it.
We've got it on tape, and we believe it. Because the people today are unaware of what things were back then.
Of course.
And yet, wouldn't you say, give us a little background on your home life, in spite of the low income, right?
Yes.
How did you, on what level would you say your family lived?
Oh, we lived.
You had enough to eat?
We had enough to eat. During the Depression, at that time, you didn't move out of the house. You lived at home with your parents till you got married. So even when I was making 10 bucks a week, I contributed money to my parents. My father, he was out of work.
Everybody did that, didn't they? Sure. Most young people paid their parents out of their salary.
I lived at home and I had to do that.
Yes, that was accepted. So what made your family decide to leave, and you too leave Dayton?
Well, let me go through.
Is there more?
Yeah.
When all right. Up to 1949, is that it?
No, up till 1941, I was Sunday editor. I'll try to revisit this. It was 1941. I was made Sunday editor of the Dayton Journal Herald.
Okay.
In 1943, I was drafted. And I contributed...
For the war.
Yeah, I contributed very little. I was stationed during World War II in Dayton, Ohio. It was Wright Field then. It's now the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I was 33 years old when I was drafted. And when they were taken... And I was not eligible for infantry in overseas
action. You were single at 33? Childless married man.
Yeah.
That's why you were eligible.
Yeah, but anyhow, I, in Dayton, I'd been in the Army and I got out in 1943 and I returned to reporting on the Dayton Journal Herald.
Why did you get out in 1943? The war was still going on.
The war was still... Oh, no, I'm wrong.
Well,
I was drafted. I was inducted in 1943.
That's better.
I was discharged in 1945.
Of course, you had a baby because the war was over.
2.5 years, and my wife... What did they pay Buck Privates then? $28 a month or something? Not much more, as I recall.
Yeah,
so my wife went to work.
I see.
And... I got out in 1945, and I went back to reporting at the Dayton Journal Herald.
But you were never sent overseas.
Never sent overseas.
You worked. You did your duty
right at home.
How lucky can you be?
Yeah,
you were lucky.
Lucky.
Did you? You want to say anything about your Army experience?
No,
from
I did
a Jewish
mostly,
angle.
No.
How
no.
was it? Any anti-Semitism in the Army?
No, not where I was. Not at Wright Field. It was then Wright Field. I worked on the Post newspaper most of the time.
A cushy job.
Yeah, they. I went to Camp Atterbury in Indiana, they assigned me to Wright Field. So.
And your wife?
My wife stayed in Dayton.
And you had weekends off?
We had, yeah.
You had a pass, an Army pass.
A pass to get off. We kept our apartment.
Right. And how was life then in the Jewish community during that war period is what we'd like to know.
Well, I was out of the Jewish community. I was out at the post, you know,
so
six
you
or
had
seven
lost
days.
Touch
so I had lost
with family
pretty much
life.
Touch with that aspect.
Well, how about in the Army? Did they, as a Jew, did you get the Jewish holidays off?
Oh, yes. I recall getting the Jewish holidays off. And another thing I will say right now, that when I worked... For Gentiles, like at the Dayton Journal Herald, I had no problem getting the holidays off. That was just accepted. It was just accepted. I had problems later, but not then.
Quite a difference from people we've interviewed who lived in New York City, where they worked in sweatshops and did not get days off, believe it or not.
Anyhow, after coming back to the Journal Herald as a... In 1945, as a reporter, one of my best assignments was to cover Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri in March of 1946.
You were sent to Fulton, Missouri?
I was assigned. We didn't fly then. We took a train to St. Louis and then a train to Jefferson City. Mm-hmm. And then coming after covering... Churchill's famous...
Why? Why did he go to that particular city?
He was, I don't recall, but he was asked by the university there at Fulton, Missouri.
Commencement speaker?
It was not a commencement. It was in March 1946. He was asked by the college to speak, and he did.
Amazing.
And on the way back, instead of going back to Dayton, I took a train to Columbus, Ohio, where President Truman was addressing the National Council of Churches.
Wow.
In Columbus. So on one day I covered
Churchill,
and a day or so later Truman.
Can you remember what was his topic?
Well,
That's pretty pressing.
Churchill's topic was that although the war was over, as I recall, there was an Iron Curtain at the Elbe River in Europe.
I see.
And that formed the Iron Curtain between the East and the West.
And wasn't it?
And there were still, and although the Russians and the United States were allies at the time, there was an Iron Curtain dividing them. And I think this was the first notion that we have that there was going to be a Cold War.
Would you say that it was Churchill at that time that developed the phrase of Iron Curtain?
Oh, here
is the one?
Yes, I think so.
Then
yes.
That's historical.
He used it in the speech.
And that became
the
accepted.
Iron Curtain became accepted ever since.
And you were there to report it.
That's right.
How about that?
In Jefferson
that's
City.
That's history.
Yeah.
Jefferson City?
Yes.
I know, Fulton, Missouri. Fulton, Missouri. Jefferson City is the capital. Fulton, Missouri.
But yeah.
Oh, what's the college? Wait a minute. I think, you know, I should have researched this.
It was
Westminster College is in Fulton, Missouri, and I think there was some connection there. And that's why Churchill was willing to come.
That sounds more like it.
This was part of an American trip he made. Of course, he was in Washington on that trip.
Well, were you just representing your hometown newspaper?
I covered it for my hometown newspaper, Dayton Herald.
Big national news.
Oh, yeah. Well, occasionally we assign reporters to national stories.
Yeah.
And that's why I say my editor, Deke Young, wanted me to be what he thought was a star reporter. Shortly after my discharge, the war ended not long after I was discharged. I was assigned...
45.
I was assigned to go to... to Fort Dix. Well, we went to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and then we went up to the piers in New York City and welcomed back and covered the return of the first United States Army division to return after the war. It was the Black Hawk Division, and my job
from
was...
From Europe.
Returned from Europe,
right.
And my job was to interview GIs who had been in Europe, were returning with the Black Hawk Division, and who were from Dayton or nearby cities. And as they came off the gangplank, I would just stand there and say, "You from Dayton, from Dayton, from Dayton." And occasionally a GI would step out of line, and we were allowed to interview them.
And you got the real feel of what things were like in those days.
Sure.
Would you like to tell us? What were things like in 1945?
Well, if I can remember, you and people who lived that through that era knew that we had gas rationing. We had stickers on our windshields that permitted us to get a certain number, a limited number of gallons of gasoline a week. We had ration coupons. We were limited in the amount of meat we could buy.
Why? Do you think because the war had taken...
The war had taken over. The country was I don't know if this country can ever do that again. You lived through that. It was 100% war effort.
Everything was shipped overseas.
And everything was shipped overseas, and everybody collected cans that were recycled, I guess, at that time, and used in the war effort.
So even 1945, you're saying after the war, things were not normal.
Oh, things
by
were
any
not,
means.
Not normal for a while, no.
And how, but you can't tell us how the Jewish community fared through it.
I I didn't see any great impact, any change that the war had and its impact on the Jewish community in Dayton. Mm-hmm.
Jews, would you say, were merchants and therefore were in business there and didn't suffer necessarily?
Jews were in business. You're right. They were the merchants because they couldn't get executive jobs at corporations.
Or in the mills. They were not hired, right?
Well, there were no mills. There were factories in Dayton, but the people I knew in Dayton didn't work in factories. I knew of one Jewish fireman in Dayton. I didn't know of any Jewish policeman. And I was surprised when I moved to Pittsburgh that there were a few Jewish policemen and firemen. They just didn't work in those jobs in a Midwestern city of 150,000 population.
Did they not choose to work, or were they not accepted?
That's
a good question, and I have no idea. I never probed. It was just never a question. But I would suppose that if a Jew had applied for a job as a policeman, discrimination would have revealed itself.
Absolutely.
I'm sure of that.
We lived through that.
Anyhow, I stayed in Dayton till 1949. And our paper, the Journal Herald, was sold to the Dayton Daily News. Now, the Dayton Daily News had been started by James M. Cox, who had been the governor of Ohio. And I will give you a trivia question. He ran for president in 1920.
Cox's Army?
No.
No relation.
No relation.
Okay.
That's a different ball of wax entirely.
Okay.
James M. Cox was the publisher of the Dayton Daily News and other newspapers. He was governor of Ohio. When he ran for president in 1920, you answer me a trivia question.
All right.
Who was his vice presidential candidate? Number two on the ticket. I'll give you the answer.
Yes.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had been Secretary of Navy during World War
I. Wow, what a question.
So Cox ran for president and FDR for a vice president, and they were defeated by one of the great presidents, Warren Gamaliel Harding.
The greatest.
An Ohioan of whom we are all proud.
You're saying that with thumb in cheek.
Thumb in cheek.
If there is such a phrase.
So,
how about that?
In 1949, the papers I worked on, the Dayton Journal and the Dayton Herald, were sold to the Cox Publishing Company. Our two papers, a morning and afternoon paper, were merged into a morning paper. Some of our people were laid off. I was kept on. But I thought, this is a monopoly situation in which one publisher owns both daily newspapers, and I didn't like that idea. Although to this day, the Dayton News has remained staunchly Democratic, and the Morning Journal Herald has remained staunchly Republican.
It's amazing.
So, I wanted to make a change. At that time, it had been announced that the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette was going to start a Sunday newspaper. We had an editorial writer on the Dayton Herald, Mike Bradshaw, who had left to become an editorial writer at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I called Mike, and he told me that they were starting a Sunday paper, and I came over for an interview. Ironically enough, in 1946 or 47, while I was working in Dayton, I came over to Pittsburgh to be interviewed by Andy Bernhard, the editor of the Post-Gazette. But I didn't think the money was enough to warrant me moving from Dayton to Pittsburgh at that time. But in 1949, when our papers in Dayton were sold, I came back to Pittsburgh. I was interviewed by Andy Bernhardt on the telephone. And I think he made some inquiries, and he hired me. And I came to work at the Post-Gazette on March 8, 1949.
You sure know
the reason I came to work on March? I had the job in about January of 1949, but I had been assigned by the Dayton Journal-Herald to go to Detroit and get on the General, it was the General Motors Train of Tomorrow, which, and we wrote it into New York, and I did a story on that, which I sent back to Dayton, and from New York, this was in March, and I had gone to, this was in January, I guess. Were they having January inaugurations then? It was a cold day. I went from New York to Washington to cover Truman's inauguration. And I came to the Post-Gazette on March 8, 1949, because we had a son, Jimmy, and he was 4 years old on March 6th. 1949. We had a birthday party on March 6, 1949. On March 7, 1949, I drove to Pittsburgh, and March 8, I started to work the Post-Gazette. They were having, the paper hadn't been published yet. We put out what we called a dry run. Mm-hmm. So I worked at the Post-Gazette from 1949.
And you were married during that period?
I was married in Fort Wayne, Indiana on November 2nd. 1941 at a temple in Fort Wayne. I can't remember the name. I remember the rabbi, Rabbi Doppelt, D-O-P-P-E-L-T, officiated.
So you had to move here, find family quarters, right?
Yes.
Where did you live? Do you remember?
Well, when I moved to Pittsburgh, I came by myself. I left B, my wife, and Jimmy was 4 years old in Dayton until I could find something. I had gone to Ohio State, and one of my best friends was Meyer Berger, who is today a prominent businessman in Pittsburgh and an activist in behalf of Democratic and liberal causes. Mm-hmm. So when I knew I was coming to Pittsburgh, I wrote to Mickey Berger, ask him to find me a place to live. There were no places after the, even 4 years after the end of the war, there were no, were you here? There were no apartments.
Not here.
So he had just moved into a home on Fair Oaks Street, and he said, come live with us. I'm the man who came to dinner. I was going to stay with him a night or two and find a place to live and move out. I lived with Mickey and his wife Merle, whom I had known during my college days, for 6 weeks. And then we found a house on Maple Heights Court, which is
the one you're still living in.
The one we're still living in.
Holy cow!
It's a little cul-de-sac.
I didn't realize that.
They had built it in 19. Mike Leibov, not Mike, Nate Leibov, a builder, had built them in 1948.
Was contemporary
ones? No. Have you been up there lately? The ones on the right are the contemporary and more expensive ones. We're on the other side of the track.
Mike lives around the corner here on this floor.
Can I use your bathroom a minute?
Sure.
I'm getting worn out.
Go.
We better stop.
We're going to...